Chapter 10. It was June 1939 when famed science fiction writer Isaac Asimov wrote his first-ever robot story, Robbie, simultaneously embarking on a lifelong journey exploring the ins and outs of robotics while coining the popular term, seeing its entry into common use in the English language. Now, fast-forwarding several decades into Asimov's future, his robot dreams may have just become a reality. Sources close to Anagnorisis Technologies claim that the information giant has been engaged for the last 2 years in the development of a highly secret program, codenamed Cronus, that could potentially, quote, blur the line between humanity and machine, unquote. According to our sources, the program consists of a highly evolved superintelligence grown entirely in a lab, fully capable of thought, reason, general problem-solving, and perhaps most alarming, creativity. If these claims are true, it would mean that the scientists at Anagnorisis have realized an achievement originally thought by industry experts to be at least 30 to 50 years out of reach. Describing a level of capability far advanced to today's current AI solutions, specialized applications focusing on individual, well-defined assistance tasks such as ordering your groceries or scheduling a hair appointment. Strong AI refers to the theoretical level of machine intelligence indistinguishable from or superior to that of its creator. Among other mental powers, it includes the potential for true consciousness, which many scientists suggest implies a degree of self-awareness and introspection, elevating the machine to a level far greater than a simple computer. Howard Andropoulos, founder and CEO of competing tech giant Quadradyne Inc., stated, "It's troubling news if true." The rest of the tech community was fairly certain that this was a ways off on the timeline. We figured there was plenty of time to get the moral implications worked out before something was actually built. According to Andropoulos, the implications behind the creation of a true artificial intelligence are profound. What would such a machine think about its own situation? Could it feel? Would it know sadness or happiness? What would we do with such an intelligence, or ask it to do? What sort of safeguards would be necessary to ensure that the intelligence is benevolent? How would such safeguards be enforced? Andropoulos said. Perhaps more troubling, given the supposed levels of cognition such a machine might experience, could it be possible that Anagnorisis Technologies have ushered in a new era of legal slavery, if these reports are true? Andropoulos was not prepared to comment on this possibility when asked. However, he did note the existence of Anagnorisis's defense arm and what he referred to as the, quote, unhappy fact, unquote, that the company managed to edge out Lockheed Martin only 4 years prior by being awarded one of the largest unmanned weaponized drone contracts on record by the United States Army. You have to wonder ultimately who it is that has his finger on the trigger, or if there is a finger at all, Andropoulos said. Could it be a prophetic omen that the word robot, first popularized by Asimov so many years ago, derives from the Czech robota, meaning forced labor? Only time will tell. Edit. We have received word that Dr. Giles Guittery, best known for his work on the nationally adopted and federally endorsed Guardian program, is somehow deeply involved with Anagnorisis Technologies with regard to the Cronus project. Requests for comment from Anagnorisis Technologies have not been returned. Developing. Marcus Gennaro shook his head, a sneer twisting his already thin lips into a razor's slit, and flung the newspaper across the boardroom table at Giles. It opened and dispersed like a flock of birds as it spun through the air, leaves fluttering gently to the floor. But the top section and cover page held together long enough to slide off the edge of the table and right into his lap. It displayed a wide shot of the Anagnorisis corporate building with a grainy inset picture of an embattled Giles surrounded by a sea of news station microphones, and beyond them, a walled-off line of protesters. "They printed it on the cover of the For Real newspaper," Marcus growled. "Do you realize how much of a shitshow something has to be for them to go to that kind of trouble?" "Please, Marcus, keep this under control," said a severe woman at the head of the table. Giles racked his brain for a few seconds, trying to remember her name. He'd met her in this room a few days ago. He knew she was the CEO. She could probably buy and sell him 3 times over, but he was dreadfully unsettled, and her name simply would not come. "We're somewhat past control, Anea," Marcus chewed the words out. and yet at a simple look from her, he fell silent. Linnea turned to look at another woman who sat across from Giles. She had her head down in a stack of paper and was surrounded by a team of four people, all of whom were dressed in what appeared to be outrageously expensive suits. Jennifer? The woman looked up from the papers and shrugged.
It's not the end of the world. That's to start. There isn't really anything in the story that hurts us, outside of blowing the lid off the project before we were ready. You could even have PR spin this in a positive light. Have them state that, Mr. Gittery is here for the purposes of oversight or evaluation.
Evaluating what? Marcus asked suspiciously.
Evaluating whatever it is he's here to evaluate, she said easily.
The head of Anagnorisis' legal team, Jennifer Bear, had chewed up and spit out far worse than Marcus Gennaro in her time.
He's here to figure out whatever it is you folks have managed to build, isn't he? Look, you guys do what you want, but it seems to me that if you just come clean about why we have him here, you're getting out ahead of the story. We've done nothing illegal in building Cronus, so my only real interest at this point is the legal breach of the NDA, if there is one. From this story's point of view, executive leadership have proactively engaged an outside specialist to analyze the system for any signs of, oh, I'll call it moral impact. Not only that, you've done so before any of these hand-wringers have demanded it.
She pointed across the table at Giles.
The story that Mr. Gennaro just needlessly sailed across the table runs wild with speculation about robot slavery, and I swear to God, you can believe I never in my life thought I'd be using the phrase robot slavery without laughing my ass off, and, super killer destructo robots, basically.
Well, there are clearly no ties between Cronus and the Drone Defense Net program. It's not even the same organization. Those guys don't even know what we're doing over here, and as far as slavery goes...
You're addressing or trying to address that right now with Mr. Gittery. Just come out and say it. Get them all off your back.
Linnea and a few of her hangers-on nodded slowly at this advice. She considered things in her own time while everyone else in the room awaited her pleasure. A few moments later, they were all startled when Kevin Roth grunted,
"Oh, Christ, blinds!"
Giles flinched at the sudden outburst, noticed that Kevin was staring right past him, and spun in his chair to see what had disturbed the man. The vertical blinds were halfway through the process of closing when he turned, but he still managed to catch the black outline of three camera drones hovering outside the window.
"I don't think they were allowed this high. Isn't that illegal?" somebody whispered.
"It's a juicy story right now," Jennifer said. "Technically, it's illegal for them to film us through the window, but the tabloids don't care and always find a way to pay for an anonymous tip. It only gets worse if you try to keep a lid on it."
Linnea sighed and glanced at Marcus and Kevin in turn. "We're sure there's no exposure on this?"
Jennifer said. "Not from what we've seen so far. No IP has gotten out as far as we can tell. IT are going over everything with a fine-toothed comb."
Marcus snorted derisively.
"So we should have a more complete report by the end of the week. The only thing we've really suffered is an embarrassment, a black eye with no dollar signs attached."
"Yet," Linnea said.
Jennifer shrugged. Linnea looked at Giles, the first time she had done so directly, and said,
"How about it, Mr. Gittery?"
"Ma'am?"
"Did you or did you not, through intent or stupidity, instigate the storm of shit through which we now sail?"
"No, ma'am."
Her eyes narrowed.
"Our IT team are scrubbing through every electron of your PC and phone. You know this, obviously, which means you're either hoping they won't find anything, which would mean you're stupid, doubtful, given what I've heard, or...
or it means you had nothing to do with this at all."
"Or he didn't use those devices to spill it," grumbled Marcus.
"Yes, that's true as well," she agreed. "I think we'll all step away from this for a while and allow things to play out. Kevin, I want you to coordinate a story with the PR team, just as Jennifer suggests. Only those details necessary to settle the hornet's nest, okay? Nothing more than can be helped. Marcus, you head back up to the lab. Start your own investigation there. Start looking through employee evals. See if there's anyone with cause to be disgruntled. I'll have HR go through records and see if anyone even remotely involved has been let go within the last 6 months."
Marcus sighed heavily, glanced murder at Giles, and said,
"I really don't have the time for this."
"Correction," Linnea interrupted. "As of now, you have time for nothing else. I want to see a report by COB tomorrow."
He sighed again and nodded.
"Now you," Linnea said, looking again at Giles. I suggest you head back to your hotel and wait to be contacted. This might take a few days.
What about Cronus? Giles asked.
I beg your pardon.
Cronus, I haven't finished testing. He was cut off by Marcus's unhinged laughter.
You think you're getting back in there? Are you delusional?
Just a minute, Kevin called. We don't know if he did anything yet. Let's wait for the investigation to play out before deciding.
Oh, jeez, Marcus snorted.
He buried his face in his hands and continued to laugh bitterly.
I'm not done evaluating him, Giles pushed on. I'd only just begun. I'd like to see this through.
You said evaluating him just now, Kevin mused.
Giles blinked rapidly for several seconds. He had not realized what he said.
Mine's already made up, Marcus asked. I do so look forward to your unbiased report.
Marcus, Linnea warned. You have a great deal of work ahead. I'd like to see that report as soon as possible, please.
The room became deathly silent as he gathered his things to leave. He paused once at the door, and Giles thought another hateful look would be shot in his direction, but there was none. Marcus let himself out, shutting the door quietly.
Here's what will happen next, Mr. Guittery, Linnea continued. You'll sit tight a while, just a little while, and wait while we get this all sorted out. If we determine, as you claim, that you had nothing to do with this, we'll then decide how to proceed, or even if we want to carry on with this effort.
After. Giles swallowed thickly through a dry throat.
What if they find something? I'm innocent, as I said, but what if they come down on a false positive?
Linnea smiled fractionally, the expression hiding some inner understanding of which Giles was uncomfortably ignorant. It made him feel like a bug under glass.
My people do not find false positives, Mr. Guittery. But either way, we'll be looking at the usual path to resolution. You'll head home. My company will sue the living hell out of your company. Some means will be agreed upon to settle out of court, and we'll all continue happily on after the dust clears. And if your people wish to continue conducting business with Anagnorisis, which of course they will, they'll need to prove their future commitment to information security by severing their ties to you.
I see, Giles said.
Good. We'll be in touch as soon as possible.
She stood from her chair. Like a comet pulling a trail of cosmic dust, the others around the table stood in response and were sucked from the room in the wake of her departure, leaving Giles alone. A few minutes later, a security guard poked his head through the door and said,
Excuse me, sir, I'm to show you out. If you'd collect your things, please.
He shared a silent, unsettled elevator ride with the guard to the first floor lobby, punctuated with sanitized music, embarrassed clearings of the throat, and a few sniffles. A chime sounded overhead, the doors slid apart, and the guard gestured to the lobby, bowing his head in deference. Giles thanked him as he exited, but felt the man fall in behind him to follow. More guards stood in the lobby, dressed in uniforms similar to the one who had collected Giles from the conference room. Collared shirt sleeves and pants with a stripe of color running down each leg, black shoes polished to a mirror shine, and hard plastic nameplates. Heavy belts with pepper spray canisters, and just enough officiousness to pass for police on a casual glance, but only just enough. They stood in a line before the exit with their backs to the lobby like a wall. The lady at the front desk hung up the phone she had been speaking into as Giles approached, looking at him sidelong as she muttered a few final words. As he picked up the pen from the counter to sign himself out, she quietly said,
"If you want to wait right here, sir, I'll have a car around to take you back to your hotel."
He thanked her and took a seat. The front entrance of the building featured an expanse of tinted floor-to-ceiling windows. He glanced through these from time to time, peeking between the legs of the guards to see the growing collection of people on the sidewalk. There were a few camera crews already set up, some even across the street, trained on men or women in designer suits speaking earnestly into microphones. Overhead were a few camera drones from the less reputable digital rags. Online gossip and clickbait sites that broke hollow stories of vanishingly little substance over numerous pages in hopes of readers accidentally clicking one in a forest of advertisements. High-end print or low-class digital trash, he had seen his face on them all. He patted a pocket in search of his cell phone, remembered a moment later he had surrendered the thing upstairs and cast about the lobby for a clock. He found three lined up next to each other on a far wall, indicating the local time, the time in London, and the time in Tokyo. In New York, it was 8:13. He scoffed and shook his head. 4 hours. 4 hours was now the amount of time required for the world to be turned on its end and send your life to hell. He felt again for his phone and sighed in annoyance at its absence. A few minutes later, the lady at the desk projected her voice in an echoing whisper to him across the lobby as though he were a prisoner awaiting a harsh sentence. She said, "Your car is here now, sir. Would you like some assistance across the sidewalk?" Giles glanced out the window at the gathering of mosquitoes encased in expensive fabrics and cheap leather, not a large gathering but growing all the same, and said, "Yes, I think I'd better, thank you." She nodded, looked at one of the guards, and said, "Merle." One of the older guards, a man shaped like a brick wall encased in fatty meat and wiry hair, nodded and said, "Over here, sir. Get in the middle, and a couple of the boys will line you on either side." They queued up at the door in the manner called for by the boss guard. Two of the men in front reached out to grab the door handles and waited. Out on the sidewalk, Giles saw the mosquitoes whirl and tense in anticipation of the ecstatic feast. The boss guard noted the set of Giles's shoulders and asked, "Done this before, sir?" "Sadly, yes." "That's good, then. Just drop your head and drive forward. We done this before, too. We'll cut you a path." The guard spoke with real pride, and Giles noted a few of the others surrounding them swell at his words. He felt a stupid, wordless gratitude for their enthusiasm and indifference. Somebody grunted, "There she pops." The doors were yanked open, and Giles was suddenly surging ahead toward a yellow cab by the curb, quite certain he would be stampeded under if he failed to step lively. A glob of transitory faces swarmed past him as if he rode a high-speed carousel, mouths and eyes demanding widely. Grunts and curses as the guards cut through like a Roman testudo. Drones swirled overhead in tightening arcs, and as he hunkered to dive through the open car door, he caught a passing glimpse of one of his own guardian units emblazoned with the iconic fist and shield staring coldly down. The cab began to move before Giles had stopped, the forward momentum helping the door to slam shut. Then he was thrust toward the plexiglass partition when the driver was forced to brake to merge into traffic.
"Christ, buddy, what have you been up to? You do something good or bad?"
"Not quite sure yet," Giles grunted. He fumbled with the seatbelt. "West in, please. It's a few blocks north of here."
"Sure, I know where," the driver said.
He goosed the engine, laid on the horn for what seemed to Giles like a full half minute, and began to scream out the driver's side window at the creeping traffic. They avoided a near collision when he cut in front of a bus, which began to honk back at them with the same enthusiasm, and the driver responded by hanging his fist out the window and screaming even louder than before. And then it was suddenly all over a split second later, the transposition of a New York minute, and all was quiet again.
"Have you there in a pinch?" the driver said.
He sniffed loudly and cleared his throat. Giles leaned into the seat and listened to advertisers hollering like fanatics over the radio. The morning traffic was otherworldly, and it took them far longer to reach the hotel than Giles would have credited. He held his breath as they trundled like dying mules along the overpacked street, and blew it all out in relief a few moments later when he saw the sidewalk was clear of reporters. He wondered briefly if he had seen the worst of it, but suspected he had not. His face had already been in the news before they had even flown out, and the world labored under a 24-hour news cycle. This recent debacle had only broken a few hours ago. He imagined things would be heating up soon, and considered leaving the city for a remote location. Anna was still in the hotel room, wrapped up in a bathrobe with her wet hair bundled in a towel. She sat on the couch in the front room with a tray of fruit and a half-eaten croissant on the coffee table. Her eyes were glued to the TV when he stepped through the door. She looked at him long enough to say, "Hey, babe," before turning back to it. She thumbed a button on the remote, and Giles heard one long-winded conversation swapped out for another. "How bad?" he asked. She shook her head. "Not so much, honestly. I've been jumping between the big networks and haven't seen anything yet. There were a few spots on the local stations, though, but so far they've only given it about 30 seconds.
There was one channel that went on for a few minutes, but that was it.
He sat beside her and rested a hand on her knee. The contact of her skin conveyed a soothing effect. He said,
"Huh, I would have thought it'd be worse.
Maybe. But no, I don't want to say anything and jinx it." Turning her head so she could look him in the eye, she said,
"I'm not sure the general public understands what you've been up to."
"Why's that?"
"Because the one channel that covered this for any length of time had to bring in an expert to explain why it's a big deal. I think it's because everyone's been hearing about AI for so long now. I mean, how long has it been since Siri's been around?"
"Well, yes, a while now, but that hardly counts. At least not when they first invented it."
"Sure, but we've been dealing with it at least since then. Voice assistants, apps, home automation. When was the last time you spoke with an actual person on the phone? I mean, when you were calling a business or something."
"Yes, that is true. So we've all been living with it to some degree or other for years," she said.
"Now this has come up, and it seems that half of the reporting has been to explain why this is different from what we're used to, and even when the expert explained it, I'm still not sure anyone got it. Just before you showed up, one of the local channels did one of those obnoxious street interview segments, you know, just walking around asking random people what they thought about it, you know, what happened. One of the people they stopped said, 'Well, can the damn thing fix my Wi-Fi? I've been trying to get it set up for weeks, and the stupid cable company won't send nobody to my place to fix it up.' And then the whole segment devolved into the anchors laughing and cracking jokes about the guy's cable."
Giles grimaced and looked out the window.
"Jesus,"
she continued.
"The expert they had on the one channel was forced to explain how a real AI is made. They kept asking if you'd programmed Cronus and started peddling super genius conspiracy theories as if you or some other scientist actually wrote the code for Cronus's intelligence line by line. They couldn't help themselves, and every time this expert had to correct them, it was like they couldn't hear him."
"You're kidding," Giles sighed.
"They can't actually think. Some people do, babe."
"Ugh," he groaned.
"I refuse to believe there are still that many ignorant people out there. A single neuron has thousands of synapses. For God's sake, there are neurons in the cerebellum alone that have hundreds of thousands of synapses. There are 100 billion neurons in the human brain. There could be as many as 1,000 trillion synapse connections, and we don't actually know what the real number is. There isn't a person or army of persons of any size that could develop that kind of complex functionality to run out of the box. The best we could ever do is build the platform and let the damn thing grow itself, as we have done already."
Anna rested a hand on his forearm and said,
"Giles, most people don't even understand what it means to write a simple program. It seems so easy and common to you because you've worked in this field every day of your career, but to the rest of us, it's like witchcraft."
"Illiterate, backward cave people," he grumbled, and she hit him in the arm. Hard. He regarded the TV for a while as he massaged his bruised shoulder, thinking.
"Have you looked on Twitter?" he asked.
She cringed.
"Yes, things are different there. You're starting to trend again."
He sighed.
"Bad."
She did not respond, as doing so would have been unnecessary.
"Yeah, well, they're all a bunch of shit-flinging fuckwits anyway."
"Oh," she recoiled.
"Ugly, babe. No, Anna, honestly, fuck them all. They're bullshit crusades, swarming like a goddamn mob whether they know what the hell they're talking about or not.
Giles, stop. I don't like being around you when you get like this. If you want to keep going on like that, you can do it on your own. I'll go in the other room or head out for the day. It's ugly." He heaved a long, trailing sigh.
"I'm sorry. I'll stop."
"We need to get out," she said abruptly. "Let's go see the city, babe, and get our minds on something else."
He considered this. Touring a city full of people whom he regarded uncharitably at the present moment did not in fact sound like a good time.
"I don't know. I'm supposed to be waiting on a call from Anagnorisis, and I should be working on some sort of tests for Cronus, assuming they'll ever let me within 100 miles of it again."
"How did it go this morning?" she asked.
"Well, they didn't beat me with clubs, so that's a good thing."
She tugged at his sleeve. "Baby. Baby, come on, let's get out. Let's take a day and just be on our own. Don't think about the news or Cronus or the test you're supposed to be designing. Let's get away."
"You don't understand, Anna.
This is so big. If I get it wrong...
She tugged harder. He looked at her, saw the look in her eyes. It was frantic, bordering on some breed of heartbreak. And he realized in a flash that she assigned a weight to her ability to bring him away. The value of their love was somehow defined by his willingness to hear that simple desire, to just go, to forsake all else. He understood his resistance might very well damage them in a way he could not later repair, and knew he must give in. And because he understood that she was the thing he treasured in life before all things, before himself, even before his own greatness, giving in to her desire was reducible to a matter of reflex.